All right. So we've been talking about economics, and to briefly recap, I started out explaining that economics, at least as I and some other economists see it, is not a set of questions to be answered, but a way of answering questions. It's an approach to understanding behavior based on the assumption that the best way of predicting behavior is an individual will take the action that best achieves their objectives, which is what economists somewhat confusingly call rationality. And that approach can be applied very broadly. I discussed my first published article on the size and shape of nations going back the last 1,500 years, roughly. It can be applied to making sense of legal systems, which we'll talk about in another week or so. It can be applied to trying to figure out why divorce rates got so much higher in the last century or so. Variety of other things, anything which involves certainly human behavior and arguably to some extent even animal behavior, you can try to solve in that way. You might discover that word if you're asking about the behavior of an individual just after he has stepped off a cliff. Physics is more useful than economics in explaining that, but there are a lot of areas, including some where at first glance you might think rationality wasn't useful, where some economists, myself among them, argue. I mentioned the case of crimes of passion, which seem irrational, where I was actually trying to make a rational model of the commitment strategies that led me. I discussed briefly the coordination problem, the problem of how, with a whole lot of different people with different objectives and different bits of knowledge about the world, you could somehow coordinate their behavior so that complicated things like making a pencil, which ultimately involved the cooperation of millions of people, some know one part of how to do it and some another, how that could be done. And I suggested that there are basically two approaches to solving that problem. One of them is centralized control, which works for small groups of people, but which scales very badly. If you're going up to populations of millions or hundreds of millions, it is very hard for any central authority to funnel, as it were, all of the dispersed information people have to figure out what to do, to monitor people to make sure they're doing what they ought to do, and so forth. And the alternative mechanism, which is, I think, harder to understand, but scales much, much better, is a decentralized mechanism, which basically means some version of prices, markets, and exchange. Because in that system, I make a set of decisions, you make a set of decisions, you get the information on the cost of my producing what I'm producing and the price you can get it for. If producing copper becomes harder, you don't have to know why, whether it's that a copper mine has failed in Chile or that new uses of copper have appeared and are therefore bidding it away. All you need to know is it's gotten more expensive, so whatever you are doing, you should, if you can, use less copper and more. So it's quite a complicated decentralized mechanism, but which turns out to coordinate very large numbers of people pretty effectively, which is why we have the world. A full explanation of how that works would take at least a semester of price theory, I think. If you're sufficiently interested, I've got two books you could read. One of the less readable ones up for free on my webpage, and the more readable one is called Hidden Order, which is the rewrite of that attempt for the intelligent layman instead of a textbook, but that you have to buy from Amazon or fuck it out of the library. There are several copies in the library here because my publisher wouldn't let me web it. And I generally web my books when I can. One of the questions you're going to want to ask, and we'll be talking about more later, is if you're thinking about alternative solutions to the coordination problem, and I'm really thinking less of centralized versus decentralized, than of different versions of decentralized. So you can imagine a decentralized system with freedom of contract, where the courts will enforce any contract you imagine a decentralized system with all sorts of restrictions on freedom of contract. The courts will only enforce the contract they approve. That would be a very minor example. You can imagine a tort system, tort law with requiring negligence for liability, strict liability, with imperative negligence. Presumably, all of you know some of the ways in which legal rules can differ. And in comparing those, or in looking at issues outside of law, if you're saying, is it a good thing to have tariffs, for example, protect your local industry? Is it a good thing to have restrictions on immigration? All of those questions, part of what you're going to do is to use economics to analyze the effect of them, and part of it is to have some criteria in some way in which you can judge one effectiveness. And the one that economists usually use, we call economic efficiency. We'll be getting more into it later. But think of it for the moment by the metaphor of the total size of the pie. Ask, is it more or less true under these circumstances that people get what they want? And then you have the obvious problem, how we judge a case where I get less of what I want, you get more of you, or what you want, and we can discuss that. That's the sort of underlying problem. The simplest version, really, of real economics is perfect competition, which is a simplified model that abstracts away from some of the complications of real interactions, but it has the virtue that it's a pretty good description of some markets, and that it is more nearly soluble, that is, we can more nearly actually figure out what will happen under it, than more elaborate realistic models. And the basic perfect competition model is one where you have an infinite number of producers and an infinite number of consumers. Therefore, each of them can take prices as given. I don't have to worry that if I buy more, it'll get up the price, or if I produce more, it'll drive down the price. And that means that rather than having the strategic problem, which, as we discussed before, is a hard problem of, if I do this, how will he react kind of questions, I can just say, as far as I'm concerned, the rest of the world isn't people at all. The rest of the world is the list of prices that I'm facing, and I can best achieve my objectives facing that set of prices. So that's part of the reason that we like perfect competition. And then there are some other simplifying assumptions. Basically, you usually assume that there are no transaction costs, that you can buy and sell, and the cost is just the price. You usually assume that people are fully informed about what's available at what price, that sort of question. So simplify things away. And I then started getting into the idea of demand curves and supply curves, which turned out to be useful tools in making sense of this stuff. And I keep thinking that I ought to bring my own markers. There's another one here. So, what is a demand curve? An individual demand curve, your demand curve for apples, is simply a graph showing at any price how many apples you will buy. And really, you ought to think about it as more like how many apples per week you will buy. Most demands and supplies really are flows. So many cars per year, not numbers. But most of the time, we ignore that and talk about it, because most, some exceptions, and most of the time, we just say, or a quantity of apples, price of apples. And you could say, well, if apples were really expensive, if they were up at this price, I wouldn't buy any at all. If they're down here at $2 a piece, I'd buy one a week. If they were really cheap, if they were free, this is how many apples I'd consume a week. So you could imagine grabbing something like that. And notice that one implication of the fact that this is really a rate and not a number is that it really is a continuous curve. Because while you're unlikely to eat 5.5 apples, you might easily eat 5.5 apples per week if you were really eating 11 apples every 2 weeks. So that's what a demand curve is. And you can then say, given any price, here is the quantity. And often what we're interested in is not the individual demand curve, but the market demand curve, which is the sum. If there are five people out there and this is the price of apples, how many apples will get sold? Well, if that's one demand curve and that's another, we could say, well, at this price, he'll buy that many apples, he'll buy that many apples, and he'll buy that many apples. So the total is this plus this plus this out there, which you could think of as the horizontal sum of these lines. That makes sense. You're just adding up the horizontal for each price. So that's what a demand curve is. A supply curve, again, notice that in common language, people often talk as though demands were fixed. They say, how many apples do you want? And not uncommonly, they think as though they really were fixed, so that people tend to say, well, if there is a shortage of gasoline, that means there's just enough. There isn't as much gasoline as people want. But of course, how much gasoline people want depends, among other things, on how expensive it is. If you compare, let us say, Europe to America. In Europe, gasoline is very heavily taxed, and that's one of the reasons why European cars are small. I was reminded of this because I was reading a bit in a short story by James Butcher, an author my son is very fond of. He's really pretty good. He's writing tough guy detective stories with magic, which is fun. But there's a line in it where the protagonist is talking about his rather odd and very large dog, that the dog weighs more than most European cars. And I say, why European cars? Aha! Because European cars are small. Why are they small? Because yes, also because European streets are narrow. And also because Europeans are on average poorer than Americans. All of those factors. Anyway, so all I'm saying is that it's useful to distinguish between your demand, which is a relationship between price and quantity, and your quantity demanded, which is a function of price. And you can say, well, I assume, I'm used to, how much gasoline do I consume? I consume 20 gallons of gasoline a month. That's how much gasoline I need. And people then sort of implicitly assume that if there's a shortage of gasoline, that just means there'll be lines. But of course, what normally happens when there's a price control is when there's a shortage of gasoline. The price goes up, people find various ways. Function of price and not. All right. Now, one of the very interesting things you can use demand curves for is to answer the question, how much is it worth to me to have the opportunity to buy something? This is low odor. It says it's dry erase. It's just dry erasing. So let's go back. I just want to draw one line on here. That's my demand curve for apples. And then one question we could ask is, suppose that today apples are $2 a piece. How much better off would I be if they were $1 a piece? Right? And you're tempted to say, well, at $2 a piece, I buy 3 apples per week. So at $1 a piece, I'd be getting those 3 apples for $1 less, so I'd be $3 a little better off. Can you see why that's not the right answer? Or if you prefer, what's the other wrong answer? How would you answer the question, how much better off am I when the price of apples drop from $2 to $1? What? I have more apples and less money. And the problem is, how do we decide? Presumably, I could have chosen to just buy 3 apples. And in that case, I'd have the same number of apples and more money, because I'd be spending $3 less. The fact that I instead buy 5 apples must indicate that I prefer 5 apples minus $5 to 3 apples minus $5. That's the way I do it. And we know, surely I prefer 3 apples minus $5, sorry, 3 apples minus $3, to 3 apples minus $6, which is what I would have if the price hadn't changed. So, any ideas on how we would figure out how much better off I am? Anybody? Well, let's do it in steps. First, suppose that I chose to just buy the same quantity as before. In that case, I'm better off by $1 per apple times 3 apples. Happy with that? Which, for the geometrically inclined, is the area of that rectangle, right? $1 price drop times $3 quantity. How about, made a little complicated by the fact that apples are lumpy. But suppose I bought one more apple now at this price. We know that I'd be willing to pay $1.50 for that apple. Because we know that if apples were $1.50, this would be my quantity. Alright. So therefore, if I'm willing to pay $1.50 and I only have to pay a dollar, I'm making a 50 cents per apple as it were gain on that apple.
So that adds in that area. But this is really the loneliness of the apple that's fooling us. Because really, what this tells us is, as it were, the last bite of that fourth apple was worth $1.50 per apple worth of a bite. It doesn't tell us that buying the fourth apple wouldn't make me, even $1.50 wouldn't make me better off. It only tells me that I wouldn't have bought any more than that. All right? So suppose I make these numbers, let me make these numbers much larger numbers, so that we can think of this as something closer to a continuous curve.
Right.
In that case, the 301st apple is worth about that much to me. The 302nd is worth about that much. All right. Each apple, if you think of it going down, the fact that I would buy one more apple at this price means that one more apple is worth at least that much to me. Therefore, my gain is what it's worth minus what it costs. Therefore, my gain as I move from here out to here is actually this whole triangle. One little rectangle. Make sense? Yes? No? For any of you who are comfortable with calculus, the demand curve under most circumstances is equal to the marginal value curve, which means the curve showing how much more value you get for each additional apple. And the area under it is the integral of the marginal value, which is total value, and the area under it minus what the area of what you're paying for it is this shaded area. Alright, so a different way of putting it. Suppose I'm making you a different way of making the same statement. Suppose instead I was asking the question, which in some cases would be interesting, what's the highest price you would pay? Make this apples per year, alright? What's the highest price you would pay to have 500 apples per year instead of no apples at all? The demand curve shows if apples were $1 a piece, they could buy 500 a year. But that isn't the same thing as saying that if the alternative were having no apples, that's the most you'd pay. Because after all, when you're buying 500 at $1, you know that you also have the option at $1.10 or $1.90 or something. All right. So that the last apple you're buying represents the gain to you of one more apple, not the average of the value of all the apples. Make sense? Doesn't make sense. Alright. I think we talked about declining marginal utility when we were talking about insurance, and the same argument says that if you imagine you're starting with zero apples a year, boy, having one apple a year would be nice and so crunchy. By the time you get to what, 3 apples a day, 1,000 apples a year, you know, one more apple, I can take it or leave it alone. Right? That would be a typical, not inevitable, but a typical pattern that the additional value of each additional unit gets less the more you have. And similarly, that suggests that the additional value of one more apple when you had none was $4 an apple, roughly, on this graph, which is why you buy your first apple at a price of $4. And by the time you get down to $1, it's at 500 apples that one more apple is worth. If you think about it that way, that's able to total value to me of all of these apples. What's the value to me of this apple? Well, I'd be willing to pay $4 for it if I had to, so therefore it's worth $4 to me. What's the apple of the next one? $3.99. Just run down this curve, and you've got a whole series of rectangles, each of which is the value to me of having one more apple. Add them up, and that's the total value of having all those apples. Then you say, well, how much better off am I being able to buy my 500 apples at $1? This is what I'm getting. This is what I'm paying for it. Therefore, this is my net value. Does that make sense? The name of that is consumer surplus. Consumer surplus, because it is the surplus for the consumer of the value of what he gets over the value of what he gets. And if you think about it, that's a very powerful concept, because that means that instead of either saying, well, when you're looking at changes, if you can only figure out how they change supply and demand curves and prices, you're in a position to say how much better or worse you would be desiring as a result. Right? One of the things that a lot of people, I think, don't understand about economics is that ultimately the values in economics are not dollars, pieces of green paper we can print very cheaply.
The values are ultimately people getting what they want, people not having to work when they'd rather be reading a book. They basically cost and benefits to people, which then show up in prices, and therefore we end up putting in terms of dollars. So this is.
Can I just clarify? So yes. You're saying how much better off are you if the apples are a dollar? $2.
I've asked several different questions.
Okay. One of them is what this graph is showing is how much better off are you being able to buy all the apples you want at a dollar than there being no apples. If I had drawn this line, that would be the same thing for $2. The area between them then is the improvement when prices drop. Is that clear?
Yeah.
Right. No, I agree. I'm going over this stuff faster than I should, but it's important. So that's a way of answering the question that I probably unfairly was asking you to figure out the answer to yourself, since it's one of the, I think, major breakthroughs in economics, which of how much better off or worse off one is due to opportunities. Actually, let me stop for a moment and take any more questions on that while I think about what I want to say next. Oopsie, one of these I think is not urgent.
All right.
Let's go on to think about the mirror image of a demand curve, which is a supply curve. And I like to think about it, intuit that way, as the supply curve for a single individual doing some kind of work. So when I say, I am a kid mowing lawns, there are other things I'd like to do with my time, but money is nice to have, and here is the price somebody will pay me to mow a lawn. And if the price is less than $5, I don't mow any lawns at all. My time is worth more than that. But as the price I get for lawns goes up, the number of lawns I'm willing to mow goes up. All right?
Makes sense.
So that's sort of like a demand curve, only the other way around, supply curve. And actually, if you think about it carefully enough, you can think of a supply curve as really being sort of the upside-down demand curve for my own leisure. Because why don't I want to spend my time mowing lawns? Because there are other things I'd rather do. I'm giving up. And one way of putting it is, when I turn down an offer to mow a lawn, I'm buying some leisure by giving up the money I could have gotten for that. So you can really think of them as very close. Anyway, so here's the supply curve. And now for the supply curve, we can do exactly the same thing we did before. We can say, how much better off am I being able to mow as many lawns as I like at $10 a lawn than if nobody wants to pay me? Well, first lawn I mow, I'd be willing to do it for $5 and being paid $10, so I'm getting a $5 bid. $5 times one lawn, is that more than I pay? Okay? Second lawn I mow is lawns per week, say. Trying to decide, shall I mow one lawn per week or not? The answer is a $5 better off a week, mowing one lawn a week if I mow no lawn. How about two instead of one? Well, that second lawn I'd be willing to mow for whatever this is, $5.50 or something, being paid $10, so I'm getting about $4.50 on it. Add up those little rectangles all the way across, and instead of having the demand curve, we had that the area under the curve and above price was equal to the benefit to the consumer of being able to buy all he wanted at a price. For the supply curve, the area above the supply curve and below price is the value to the producer of being able to sell all he wants. And now at this point, I'm thinking as if producers and consumers are single individuals. But first, if you imagine that instead of one person buying apples, there are a bunch of people buying apples. If you horizontally add their demand curves, which is about like this for those ones, If you think it through, you will see that the area under this curve is the sum of this area plus this area. So in fact, the argument that says that for the individual, the area under his individual demand curve is equal to the value to him of being able to buy at a price, under the demand curve above the price, actually. Similarly, for a group of individuals, you can sum their demand curves, and you're just summing the areas. You can play with paper and pencil and geometry, you can buy and get yourself that. And therefore, you can make statements about consumer surplus, not just, yes.
Sorry, can you say that again?
Sure. I started out arguing that for a single individual, the benefit of being able to buy at a particular price is the area under his demand curve and above that. What I am now saying is, if you think about two individuals, you could write their summed demand curve, how many apples the two of them together would be buying at any price. That would be the horizontal sum of those two demand curves. Number of apples I buy, quantity on the horizontal axis, plus number of apples you buy is number of apples we buy. If you think through the geometry, you ought to be able to convince yourself that the area under that summed demand curve is the sum of the separate areas under the you are convinced of that, that then tells you that if you have a market demand curve showing the total demand for apples, everybody on the market, that the area under that demand curve and above the price is going to represent the benefit to everybody in the market of being able to buy apples at that price. Turns out the same thing is true for supply curves. What would be much more complicated, I'm not going to pretend to prove it to you, although you may be able to persuade yourself if you feel like reading a bunch of economics, is that there's a pass-through. That is to say, if you imagine, think about a car company. The company itself doesn't suffer any loss of leisure. It's not a person. But it's buying inputs. For example, the labor of its workers. And it turns out that if you look at the supply curve for the company, the area above that curve and below the price ends up being the sum of those areas. If you pushed it all the way back to the individuals who are actually doing the work, supposing labor was the only input for a moment to make life easy, then it would be the sum of the value to all of the workers of being able to do the work that resulted in you producing 1 million cars a year would end up being the producer surplus of the firm. Now, as you have more inputs, it adds up. So that's not trivial. That's not something that we can prove, but it's relevant because what it's saying is that even a real economy is a layer cake, all right? It's not just I'm mowing lawns and you're having lawns mowed. It's I am assembling cars and he is helping to make steel and she's helping to make glass and the car company is buying the services of all of us and putting them together into a car and then they're selling them to somebody. It turns out that the simple rule of producer surplus for the individual producer also carries through where the producer surplus for the firm ends up being a summed producer surplus for everybody. I should say that in a perfectly competitive market, the firm's profits are zero as economists define profit, that is, after paying for all inputs, including the use of capital. Often profit is thought of as the return on your capital. But from the economic standpoint, using capital, the use of capital is an input too. Therefore, you have to think about its price. And in perfect competition and perfect information, as long as after paying for all inputs, there's something left, another firm will join the industry because you're getting something for nothing on that. And therefore, firms come in until you end up with the profit of the individual. Zero. So all the producer surplus, if you thought of, again, summing the supply curves for a whole bunch of firms, for an infinite number of firms in principle in perfect competition, the sum supply curves still slope up, even though the individual firm is making no profit, and the reason is that all of that area under the price line is really being passed down to the people who are providing the inputs to the firm, whatever those are. It might be landowners who are renting land to the firm, it might be people who save money and are lending it to the firm at interest. It might be workers. It's probably all of those. Many things. So,
So the supply curve, it records both a single event and then also a number of events on the supply.
But tells you by the bit. The supply curve, like a demand curve, is showing what would happen. So the supply curve is saying, if the price I could get from one along was $5, I'd know no loans. No loans. That's any access. This is terrible, right? If it got up to $6, say maybe I'd know one loan per week, right? And so forth. So it's not that these are all events. Presumably the price is whatever the price is. This is a description of what I would do under very certain. Maybe after the price will go down, it will change. If you could describe a supply curve, even in fact the price is always $10, you can still say, well, if it were $5, what would you do? If it were $7, what would you do? And that's relevant to figuring out how desirable it is to me to be going along to $10. So you can imagine for a moment that the kid's got a choice. Suppose he says, look, this curve describes a situation when I'm regularly mowing lawns. So that involves a certain amount of practice. I've got it, you know, my lawn mowing machine working and so forth. There's an alternative. I could be delivering newspapers instead. I can't do both. At least it's not practical to do both, given the specialization, essentially. So I would say, what's the net benefit to me of mowing as many lawns as I want to mow at the price of the lawn? What's the net benefit to me of delivering as many newspapers as I want to deliver at the price I can pay for that, which is higher? That's relevant to my deciding what I want to do. Right? So it doesn't depend on a bunch of different events. It depends on essentially what's really inside my head, namely what would I do under your earnings circumstances.
That's different than, say, multiplying 10 by 5 and getting 50 and comparing $50 to 60.
Absolutely different. Of course, suppose somebody says you've got a choice. You can get $50,000 a year working an 8-hour day as a lawyer for a cause you really believe in, for an innocence project. Or you can get $60,000 a year trying for partner working 12 hours a day, 7 days a week for firms that are mostly litigating for people you hate. Do you really want to say that the only relevant question is what's the amount of money you're getting? Alright. But here's a supply curve would be different. If you think about it, if you think your willingness to do the job depends not only on how much you're being paid per hour, but also on the conditions of the job. A lot of different areas. You know, it might be that you really like doing some things. And for those, your supply curve would start really low prices, might even go to negative prices. Right, what's your supply curve for playing tennis? You know, if you're a tennis player, your supply curve for playing tennis goes down somewhere like that, because even if you got paid on the court, you're willing to do it. That's a negative thing. So, of course, your supply curve it's not enough to say how much people are making. That's why, if you say the stimulus project has resulted in people making $1 million a year extra wages in your town, that doesn't mean that those people are $1 million better off. They're feeling better off, they wouldn't have taken the job. You don't know how much, you have to know how much the time they gave up was worth. How much, what other things they might have been doing. They might have been working at a lower wage, but it's something they like better. You don't know, you have to know. So that even if it were the case they would be doing nothing otherwise, you assume they're fully unemployed. Unemployed, at least for me, means I'm browsing the web and reading good books and talking with people and doing lots of things that I might enjoy better than working for whatever job than you are. Filling a pothole for whatever job. So you can't just judge by looking at the money, but what this does is tell you what you've got to add to the money, namely the supply curve, which at the individual level really represents the issues of the need you were working. Right? You're saying, I'm willing to do this last lawn only if I can pay that $10 for it. Why? Because my disvalue for spending my time in that way is about $10.
So, as I say, so it turns out that this mechanism can go way beyond the individual level and therefore is a set of tools that you can use to answer a question such as, if we put on a tariff on importing automobiles, how much worse off are consumers, how much better off are producers? And it turns out that's more complicated than it first seems, because one result of that tariff will be to reduce our exports of grain. because the people who get our dollars for their cars are not going to eat those dollars, and ultimately those dollars are going to come back. They might come back to buy land in the U.S., but simplest case, they come back to buy U.S. export goods. So if you're curious, I've got a chapter on my web price theory, that's the book which is available for free to read, where in a world where you only have two goods, one import good and one good that we on that import and one we on that export, I show how you would use graphs like this. Takes a while, it's not trivial, but to show that on net, the tariff makes us worse off. That the cost to the consumers plus the producers of export goods is larger than the benefit to the producers plus the consumers of export goods, because of course when the Japanese buy less grain, the result is grain prices go down in the U.S. and that makes grain cheaper in the U.S. So you've got to take all of those into account. But you can in fact use these tools to answer that question in a way in which you really couldn't answer. It's hard to say you can answer without tools like this to sort of sum the net effect of. And if you try to say, well, how much money do people get? How much money do you lose? That wouldn't answer the question. That would be the tempting wrong answer. All right, so let me point out what happens to these arguments in a somewhat different situation where you don't have a freely moving prices, where people can't simply buy as much as they want. Because notice that in the market situation, you can always buy as much as you want at the price in ordinary market. Now, it's true that after the Arabs stop exporting oil to us, people end up buying less oil. But that's less gasoline, but that's because the price has gone up. So that at the new price, they can buy as much as they want, but at the higher price, they want less. Suppose you don't let that happen. Then let me take my sort of standard example, which is gasoline, because that's what we actually had price control on. Two major things you get price control on within my lifetime. And let us suppose that there is a supply curve and a demand curve, for gasoline, and let us suppose that they intersect at $2 a gallon. Actually, for my purposes, sorry, given what it is drier, it says it's drier. Maybe I should believe it. I want to take this and go farther down because I'm going to have a price control. So suppose they put in price control at $1 a gallon. The question is, what happens? At $1 a gallon, consumers want to consume this much gasoline. All right, that's what the demand curve tells you. On the other hand, at $1 a gallon, producers only choose to produce this much gasoline. That's what the supply curve tells you. Very hard to consume gasoline that nobody produces. So what happens? We've price-controlled gasoline prices at well below their market price. What do you think the result is going to be? You go to the gas, yo?
Gasoline that monopolizes gasoline. They buy up all the gasoline and then they sell it for higher prices.
They can't. They've got price control. It's illegal to sell at a higher price. You drive to the gate, you come to the gas station, you load your car. What do you find? What?
Empty.
Hmm?
There's not gas.
No gas there, right. Well, what's the obvious solution to that? That's one solution. We could get to that in a minute. Before we get to rationing, though, just figure out what's going to happen if all you do is put price control and nothing else. And what's going to happen is that people are going to say, if I want gasoline, I'm going to have to come to the gas station early in the morning or whenever, you have to know when they fill up. Everybody's going to say that. So you're going to have long lines. The lines do not increase the amount of gasoline produced. What do they do, however? What is the cost? What is the real cost to you of gasoline now? Is it only $1? What is it? It's $1 plus an hour waiting in line or whatever it is. All right. But that's going to affect the demand curve just like a money price. All right. If you've got to give up something else of value, that means you'll be willing to buy less. So let's suppose for a moment that the line got long enough so that the effective price of gasoline was back to the old price of $2. That is to say, you were spending, on average, for each gas gallon you got, a dollar in money plus a dollar in time.
At that price, demand is back at its old level.
Does that mean everybody can get gasoline with lines that long, as much as they want at that price? What's different from the situation before price control?
More supply.
Then there was more supply. This time, you're spending $2, but the gas station's only getting $1. Right? The rest is being thrown away waiting in line.
So that means that quantity supply is still here, quantity demanded is still here, there's still a gap between them.
So it's still the case, with the line at that length, that people are getting to the gas station often and there's no gas. So how do you... What?
So the supply curve isn't matching, like they're not producing more gas when it goes up to $2.
The price hasn't gone to $2.
That's what I mean, because that dollar is only your cost.
That's right. The cost has gone up to $2. But the station doesn't get anything by having you spend an hour sitting waiting in line. Probably loses something. It's, you know, crowded, more unpleasant to be working in the gas station with all those cars and they're pumping out carbon monoxide or whatever. So that means the line's going to keep getting longer, right? As long as it's the case that you get in line for a length of time and by the time you get there, there's no gas, you're willing to arrive earlier, the line gets longer,
and the line keeps getting longer until demand is down to the new quantity supplied.
Now, everybody who's willing to wait for 2 hours in line can have gasoline. And now people don't want as much gasoline, of course, because now the effective price is about $3 on this particular graph. So what's interesting about that story is that in the simple case, the case where all you have is put in price control, you don't have rationing, or there are a variety of mechanisms one can use, that the actual effect of the price control is to raise, not lower, the cost of gasoline. And that's sort of a counterintuitive result, but it's a pretty straightforward one. And it really depends on there being some way of competing to get the limited supply, in this case standing in line, such that the higher the price you're willing to pay in that form, the more you're able to get it. You're sort of bidding against other people and how long you're willing to stay in line, and then the bid rises until it rations quantity demand and down to quantity supply. We know quantity supply is less than before because the price is less, and therefore it's got to have to be a higher cost. Now, you could think of other models for what happens, but I think this one is the simplest and most right. Now, the next question, somebody mentioned rationing, which is something that very often, of course, occurs when you have shortages. Notice, though, that the non-economist is going to say something like, the reason we have a shortage now and people are standing in line is there isn't enough gasoline. And the economists say, no, the reason we have a shortage is we have price control. You could imagine that the old situation with gasoline at $2 a gallon had existed for 50 years. No shortage. Put in the price control. Next day there's a shortage. So there's the fact that the normal mechanism that makes quantity supplied equal high demand isn't allowed to function. So let's now go to the next step, which is that somebody suggests that we could have rationing, which is, let us say, get rid of that, which is a fairly common solution. Approach to the problem. So let's take the easiest case for rationing, which is where we say, all right, we're producing half as much gasoline as before. Somehow we've kept track of how much gasoline everybody used last year at the old price. And we say everybody gets ration tickets, allowing them to buy half the number of gallons that they bought last year. All right? So that is a possible solution to the problem. And each of us as a consumer now is buying this quantity of gasoline at this price. All right? So from the standpoint of the individual consumer, compared to the old situation out here, he is better off by this rectangle because he's now paying... No, sorry, by... this rectangle, because let's see, if I probably need to do more than one triangle, this is getting complicated, probably more complicated than I already got, but I'm going to go just a little bit longer. $1, $2, $3. Now, with price control, he's buying this quantity. He is paying this price for it. So his net benefit, his consumer surplus, is now that. Whereas before, his consumer surplus was this triangle. And depending on the shape of the lines, it might be high, larger or smaller, because he's gained by the drop in the price, but lost by the fact that he's no longer buying this. Right, I'm sorry. Just a minute. I've still got something wrong. I'm doing this too fast for me as well as for you. Before his consumer surplus was this triangle, was at $2 a gallon. Now his consumer surplus, if the price had gone up to $3, his consumer surplus, oh, this is right, would have been here. But since the price is only $1, his consumer surplus is all of that. And what has he gained? He's gained the drop from $2 to $1 here. So for the amount of gasoline, for the half of his gasoline that he's still able to buy, he's buying it a dollar cheaper. That's a gain. What's he losing? He's losing his consumer surplus on the gasoline he no longer can buy. All right? So he's gaining this. Think of that as the pluses. And that's the minuses. That is to say, that's the way in which he's worse off than if there were no price control. And can you see that? So the price control has made the consumer better off by the drop in price on gasoline he's getting. This is with rationing, so we're not standing in line anymore. Worse off by the lost consumer surplus on the gasoline he now can't get at all. It's not produced because of the lower price. All right. And you could, according to how you drew these curves, this number might be bigger or smaller than that one. Meanwhile, however, the producers are losing producer surplus. The producers are losing all of the producer surplus from here because their producer surplus is now only this instead of this larger triangle. All right. And if you think about it, everything he is gaining, the producers are losing. The drop in the amount he pays for the existing gasoline. But on the additional production that isn't happening, both he and the producers are losing. So it's a transfer with regard to the gasoline that he can still buy, and a net loss with regard to the gas to both sides of the gasoline that's no longer being produced. Now there's a further problem with this, which this graph can't show. And the further problem is that we've got a bunch of different consumers, and if they're not all identical, it may be that there are some consumers who can easily reduce the amount of gas they consume when the cost goes up a little bit to them. And there are others for whom it's really very difficult to. They've got their job requires a 100-mile commute to someplace where no buses go or something. And since our ration ticket is telling everybody you get half the gasoline you get last year, the result is that there is some gasoline which is being used by people to whom it's not very valuable, to whom it's worth only a little bit more than $2 a gallon, the old price. And there are other people who aren't getting gasoline, even though it's worth much more than $2 a gallon for them. So that's a further cost to the system. How might we eliminate that cost quite easily? How could we make sure that every gallon of gasoline went to the people who value it most?
You allow people to sell their gasoline.
That's right, you make ration tickets marketable. Well, it sometimes happens. It often doesn't happen. The interesting thing about making ration tickets marketable is that everybody is better off as a result, because you only sell it if you value the money more than the ticket. You only buy it if you value the ticket. And yet it often doesn't happen. And I think the reason it doesn't happen is that it is easier to justify ration tickets by saying everybody should share the pain, as it justifies price control and rationing, but everybody should share the pain, than by having a system which really says what we're doing is we're imposing price control at $3, and we're taking some of the money we're saving by that and distributing to people in proportion to how much gasoline they used last year in the form of valuable ration tickets. So again, I think I probably spent more time on this than I should. The price control is an interesting case. So the ration tickets eliminate the misallocation, but they don't eliminate the fact that you're losing both consumer and producer surplus on this triangle. All right? So let me go on to a couple of other things, which really, because when I got my lines in my outline at the moment, I'm trying to keep track of stuff I wanted to cover, which is probably too much for the number of days we have. But my problem with one of the things in the book that I think is wrong, and that is that if you look at their discussion of professional regulation, of, for example, licensing of doctors or licensing of lawyers via bar exam or licensing of barbers, which is very common in many cities, or all sorts of licensing of egg graders, a yacht salesman. There are a whole lot of professions which at the local or state level you are not allowed to practice without a license. And the book's discussion takes it for granted that the only problem with this is that the government might make mistakes, that the government is doing its best to make sure that we only have competent physicians and competent lawyers and competent barbers and competent egg graders, but given the difficulties of the situation, it might get it wrong. I think that is wildly inconsistent with the available evidence. And let me give you a couple of relevant facts in medical licensing, which I suppose is probably the most popular form of professional licensing. During the 5 years after Hitler came into power, the number of foreign physicians admitted to practice in the U.S. was about the same as during the previous 5 years. Does anybody see why that's an interesting fact? What happens when Hitler comes into power? You are an educated Jew in Germany when Hitler has just come into power. What do you think you do? You come to America, of course. And the educated ones are the most mobile. They're the ones who can reasonably expect to do well. They're also probably, you know, the ones who are most likely to have the money to travel, who are, you know, paying attention to what's going on and so forth. So you would expect that the number of qualified physicians applying to practice in the U.S. would have gone up a whole lot. And yet the number admitted did not. During the Great Depression, the American Medical Association sent a letter around to the medical schools saying that it felt that they were training more physicians than they should be training. And every medical school cut down on the number of people that admitted. The way state licensing worked then, I think still works, is that in order to get licensed, one of the requirements is that you graduate from an approved medical school. And the states get their list of approved medical schools from the Council on Medical Education and Hospitals of the American Medical Association. So that meant that letter has behind it a very potent threat, which is if you don't do what we want, we might take you off the list and then your graduates will no longer be allowed to practice. Or may be allowed to practice in their own state. I think some states have an exception for in-state medical schools. The requirements for foreign physicians, I don't know, it's still the truth, but it certainly was true for a long time, that you had to take the medical exam in English, and you had to have been licensed in the country. If you studied abroad, including in Americans that didn't study abroad, you had to have been licensed in the country. Oh, I think you had to be a citizen. I'm not certain that's right. I think that's right in the U.S., and you had to, if you got your degree abroad, you had to have been admitted to practice in the country you got the degree. Given that other countries also have restrictions, such as requiring citizenship, that means that it is very hard if the American medical schools aren't admitting enough as many people who want to be doctors for an American who wants to be a doctor to go abroad, study there, and come back, because in the worst case, if the other country requires citizenship, you'd have to renounce citizenship, get a new citizenship, renounce citizenship, get a new citizenship, which isn't really a practical procedure. So all of those suggest that there is something going on other than quality controls, and none of that makes sense if what's going on is quality control. And arguably what's going on is that in professional licensing, both at that level and many others, the group most interested in it is the profession, and what is the obvious interest of each profession with regard to licensing? The present members of the profession. If you are a barber, what is your feeling about how hard or easy it should be for other people to become barbers? Hard, of course, because that'll drive up your wage, which is why you have to take 200 hours of classes. This is a factoid remembered from I remember which city, in order to be allowed to get licensed as a barber to cut hair. So it seems to me that the basic problem with the book's presentation is that it's taking for granted a sort of a philosopher king model of government in which government is simply there to do good, and it's just that doing good is sometimes hard. And I think that professional licensing provides lots of evidence that what's really going on is a political marketplace in which various people offer various things to political actors to get the laws they want. And typically in the case of professional licensing, that means the profession controlling the licensing and using interstate entry. And you will note that the most professions, including yours, are much less strict about qualifications of people who are already in than qualifications of people who are getting in. It's not like the doctor who learned medicine 40 years ago has to provide serious evidence that he's still, medicine having changed a lot, is still competent because he's already one of the members of the group that's controlling the licensing, and they don't want to throw out people who are already in, but they much easier to exclude people from getting in. Notice also that there is an interesting alternative to licensing, and that's certifying, which of course you also get in some fields. And the difference is that with certifying, the relevant government says whether you're competent, but the customers are then free to use non-certified professionals if they choose to. And it's worth thinking about what are the arguments for licensing over certifying. And it's pretty clear that if what you want to do is to keep people out of the profession, certifying is a much weaker tool. Because if what you've got are requirements that don't really match the desires of the customers, customers are going to stop caring whether people are certified and try to find other ways of judging quality, maybe non-governmental certification of one sort or another. Whereas with licensing, it's the rest of the issue there. So in order to make a good argument for licensing, I think you have to argue that even with the information provided by the certifying, the consumer will make a wrong choice. And you could argue that. One way of arguing it is if you believe that when I use a low-quality profession, other people suffer. So if your main worry is contagious disease, you might say, well, look, if I hire a quack to cure me, I end up with a disease, you catch the disease, that's not a cost to me, so I ignore it. I don't think that one is very plausible, because the obvious response is, yeah, but the cost to me of getting sick is large enough, so I have a pretty strong incentive to try to get competent people. But the argument might be stronger for an architect. If you imagine the question of a building falling down and injuring other people, you might plausibly argue that you don't want to give a free hand to the people who are building the building. They suffer when the building falls down, but other people do. But in any case, that's a possible argument. But the alternative argument would be that consumers are irrational, that they're so irrational that even if the government tells them this physician is competent and this one isn't, they'll still go to the incompetent one if he's cheaper. Anyway, people are interested in going to more on that, but I think it's one interesting issue. Let me, any questions on this? The next thing I'm going to talk about is monopoly. So I sort of, the supply curve, demand curve, consumer surplus, producer surplus is, I think, a good deal of the basic price theory that is useful for you to know at a very, very superficial level. The other points I was just talking about, price control is an interesting application of that. I'm really talking about regulation mainly because it's in the book chapter that you're assigned to read, and I think they get it wrong, and therefore I ought to give you what I think is the more nearly correct view, which you can believe or not, it's entirely up to you. I was going to go on to talk about monopoly, which is another topic that they discuss as of some importance of law and elsewhere. Before I do, though, do you have questions that we've just done? Because I tend to keep going and people don't get a chance to cut in. Got to learn to cut in. All right. What's monopoly? Monopoly is a single firm that produces almost all of the output for a given market. And, of course, one of the things that suggests is that whether you think of something as a monopoly depends a lot on what you think of as the market. So that one could argue that Apple Computers has a monopoly. What do they have a monopoly of? Macintoshes. And if you think, as I do, that a Windows machine is not a good substitute for a Macintosh, it isn't for me at least, then it makes sense to think of the Mac as the relevant market. If you say, no, we're doing stuff where any computer will do, then we say, well, Apple, if anybody's got a monopoly, it's Microsoft has got an operating system monopoly. Even that is not a very tight monopoly because there's Apple and Linux and whatever else is out there. Nobody has a monopoly on making computers because lots of companies are making computers compatible with each other. And whether you think of Apple and Dell as in the same market depends a lot on the degree to which you think of their products as close substitutes to each other. Putting them, the extent of a market isn't a cleanly defined bright line, even though we often talk as though it was. In the same sense, suppose you had one company that was producing all of the heating oil. Do they have a monopoly? Well, they have a monopoly of heating oil. They don't have a monopoly of heating because people can use coal and gas and firewood and so forth. So, again, it's worth thinking about it. What's the implication of having a monopoly? The implication of having a monopoly is that instead of taking the prices given, you are choosing a price. So, if we go back to various of these stories we've been telling, only we imagine now that instead of a industry with a supply curve, that what we have is a demand curve and then a single monopoly producer. On that story, what is the story we've been telling look like? Well, let's go over here. And alright, so this is the demand curve. We can think of it as the market demand curve, the sum of the demand curves of all the individuals. No reason it should be a straight line except they're easier to draw. And you're the monopolist. And you've got a cost curve. Your cost curve tells you how much does it cost to produce various amounts. And I'm going to take the simplest case, and that's the one where your marginal cost is constant, meaning you can always produce one more automobile for another. That's by no means the only case, but it's a nice simple one. And you say to yourself, well, I got a choice. I could call this 10,000. I could sell automobiles for $10,000 a piece, and boy, would I sell a lot of them. There's just one problem with that. What happens if I sell automobiles for $10,000 a piece? What is the result of this guy with my stockholders? I'm not making any money. That's what they cost me to produce. Now, in a competitive industry with free entry, you may have to put up with having no profit after everything, but monopolies have a better situation. And then, how about I sell them for $20,000? $20,000, that looks much better. I got all that profit, right? That's costing me $10,000, selling for $20, I'm making $10,000 per. It's true I'm not selling as many automobiles. And it may well be that if I push it up to $30,000, even though I'd be making a lot more money per automobile, this area is less than this area, so I'd actually be worse off. So it's not, it's in one sense in which a monopolist can charge any price he likes. Competitive firm charging any price he likes too. It's just that if you try and sell wheat at more than the market price of wheat, you won't sell any. You can charge that price. The monopolist isn't extreme. The monopolist can sell some cars, he sells them 30,000 more and 20,000 still more than 10,000. And therefore his job as it were is to figure out what price in that range will maximize his profits. I assume that none of you are going to be monopolists with fixed marginal costs, so we won't have to work through the math of how you figure out where the maximum is, which doesn't really matter very much. But let me go back to the question of why you're a monopolist. What are the reasons why you might have a situation where one firm produced almost all the profit? And you could imagine cases where there's some single unitary scarce resource that you own. So imagine that what you're selling is transportation through a mountain range. There's only one pass, and you own the pass. And you know, you've got a wall and some hired soldiers and a couple of artillery pieces, and no one's going to take that pass away from you, and no one can go through without your permission. You're a monopolist on transport from this side to that side. That would be one case. And you could imagine, for example, under our law, you might have an essential patent for producing something, and that again would be equivalent to a choke point, except that it's a legal choke point rather than a geographical one. The case which a lot of people think of as fitting that but doesn't seem to
fact, it's more interesting than that is De Beers and Diamonds. That De Beers, it is, people commonly think of De Beers as sort of control of diamond production. The problem is that although certainly a lot of diamonds were produced by the De Beers consortium or something, a lot of them weren't. I figured in 1957 the Soviets were producing 20-30% of the world's supply. A number of other countries and mines controlled by De Beers represented about half of the total supply. On the other hand, much more than half of the total supply of diamonds were being sold through De Beers. And it looked, at least from the discussion I saw, as though where De Beers really had something close to a monopoly, it was in marketing, not in production. And there are some moderately complicated reasons, which you're going to have time to train, I'm not going to go into, for thinking that marketing diamonds, unlike marketing other things, might be a case where there are large economies of scale. What I mean by economies of scale is a case where the bigger firm can produce more cheaply. And if people are interested in drop three box out, which is sort of an interesting story, I'm not sure the story is right, based on that. So one possibility is a natural monopoly with economies of scale. And if you think about it, increasing the size of your firm sometimes makes you more efficient, sometimes less. If you get a bigger and bigger firm, one disadvantage, there are more and more layers between the president, the CEO, and the factory floor, so it's got, you're hiring more people to watch people to watch people to watch people to watch the guy who's doing the work, and you're doing a worse and worse job. But that's a cost. That's a diseconomy. On the other hand, you could certainly think of cases, suppose you've got a fixed cost of design, for example, and it costs the same amount to write a computer program, whether you're going to make 10 copies or 10 million copies, so that means the cost per program is much larger for the firm with the 10 million copies. That's probably the most striking modern case where you've got very large economies of scale. But it certainly could be argued that, well, it's still true, at least it was true, I gather, that in the auto industry, you had the process of stamping out auto bodies had a similar characteristic. It was expensive to make it, so were the molds of what you made. But in any case, if you have a case where the cost of production keeps going down up to a firm and selling the whole market, that would be an actual number. More common case, in my view at least, is not the case where you've got a huge market and a huge firm, but the case where you have a small market and a firm which is large only in terms of that market. So that, for example, I would like to claim that I'm an economist. That I write certain kinds of books, I give certain kinds of public lectures. I would like to believe, and I think at least some people are persuaded, that there are no close substitutes, that nobody else is going to write the books I write or the lectures I give. Therefore, I am in a situation where I could imagine charging a range of prices. Take the simple case for a self-publishing book, which I'm in the process of doing, maybe a postal book at the moment, through Amazon subsidiary. And we can choose to set the price. If you want self-published, Create Space is Amazon subsidiary, and at essentially no cost to you other than time and effort, you can have them physically publish your book. And you tell them what price they want. You want them to sell it at, and you get a cut where, of course, the lower the price, the less you get. And they get a cut. So it's an interesting model, and it may eventually displace a good deal of the standard publishing model. But if you think about it from the standpoint of the monopolist, suppose I say, look, there is no other book on medieval cooking that's comparable to the one that we produce, which is probably true. So we could sell it for, I think, about $5 a copy. It's roughly the lowest price at which our cut doesn't go negative. And sell, say, 1,000 copies a year. We could sell it for $9 a copy, which we plan to, sell 500 copies a year and so forth. So the reason we're in a monopoly position is not that my wife and I are an enormous firm, but that the total market for medieval books is very big. And therefore, it's not big enough to support a bunch of people writing such books. So in any case, the argument, what I would suggest is that while people normally think of the economics of monopoly in terms of giant firms, and such firms remain sometimes existed, it's more applicable, really, if you're imagining that you've got a small law firm that's the only law firm in your town, that you are a monopoly,
and you're going to have to think about the higher the rates we charge in this business we get. Questions? All right, let me go on. So I've discussed one reason would be that you own some critical asset like my passive. One reason is economies of scale. But then there are two other reasons, one of which I think is mostly mythical but certainly plays a considerable role in people's views, and that's what's referred to as artificial monopoly. And this comes about through something called predatory pricing. And this is the story that is told, although there's even very little historical evidence for it, about Standard Oil. And the story basically is not that Standard Oil can produce kerosene more cheaply than anybody else. People mostly don't realize that the whole Standard Oil antitrust case occurs before there is an automobile market. So therefore, what Standard Oil at the time was producing was kerosene, basically. You know, heating and, I guess, kerosene lamps and stuff like that. But anyway, the story is Standard Oil is about 90% of the market. It's therefore making lots of money. So if you're a small firm with 1% of the market, they say, we're going to sell at a loss until we drive it out. That's the idea. Does anybody see where there's a problem with that? Just as a tactical method. Standard Oil has got 90 times the revenue I had before they got prices. They had 90 times the revenue I had. They have 90 times the assets I have. I'm this 1% player, 90% player. So they, our costs are the same. Standard Oil, this is something, it's not a natural monopoly. It doesn't have to be over the costs. It costs them 20 cents to produce and sell a gallon of kerosene. It costs me 20 cents. They decide to sell kerosene at 10 cents a gallon. That's driving me out. What's wrong with this plan?
Yeah. Some people might choose to provide more expensive gasoline.
They might, but for the same way, the individual purchaser, keeping me in business doesn't provide much of a deal because after all, he's still a small part of my market. Yep.
In the loss, they would.
They're losing 90 times what I'm losing.
Yeah, but with that, worth it for you to keep your prices up because you would earn more than you're going
to. Well, I can't keep my prices up. What I can do is either cut to 10 cents or more likely just shut down for a while. But the point is, depending on which is cheaper, it might be that I've got some costs that live for a while. But the point I'm making is that if the only difference is size, if they're 90 times as big and if we're both selling for a cost for a moment, they're losing $90 for every dollar I lose. Because they got 90 times the volume. They're both selling low cost. You know, this is the old story about the guy who sells you, like, these shirts cost me 5 months, but I sell them. How can you make money? They're making a lot of money. Yeah?
Doesn't that assume that Standard Oil is cutting their prices across the board, like across
yes.
the
Yes, yes. I'm taking the very simplest case where if I was only in one local place and if for some reason I couldn't sell elsewhere, then the argument I'm making is. We actually have some historical evidence. There's a guy called, there's a book called The Myth of Retro Pricing. Journal of One. McGee, John McGee's article. And he actually read through the many volumes of the Standard Oil Antitrust Computers. And he found no examples. What he did find was an interesting case involving testimony by the head of a small oil company, Corn Planter Oil. And Corn Planter Oil said that somebody from Standard Oil came to him and said, look, you've been cutting into our market. If you don't stop expanding and cutting into our market, we're going to cut prices. And the guy from Oil said, it's all right. Cut it like, if you cut prices, we'll ship it 100 miles around and you have to cut all of that too. All right. So I'm not going to say it's logically impossible, but unless your transport costs are high, that's an invitation to the other people to sell wherever you aren't cutting. And it's also, if you're making money in other places, an invitation to other people to spoil a little bit. In any case, Rockefeller did buy out competitors, and that's part of how it got. I think at least initially he really did. Not exactly economy of scale. He was very competent at running the firm. They very did their collaterally. Don't have to say that. But pretty clear from the McGee article, at least, is that in that case, what happened was not predatory pricing. And as I say, the basic logic of the argument is that the problem with the bigger firm can drive a smaller firm out is that to the extent that it's bigger, that also means that it sells below cost. In addition, of course, if it says it cuts its price quantity demand is going to go up, so it's going to have to, we'll have to hold the price down. It's got to sell even more than it was before at the losing price. And the other firm does not have to sell at the low price. It does not sell at all. They're going to say, well, we'll sell from whatever our cheapest, our most efficient factory is, and lay off some people and cut down supplies until you guys get the But in any case, so I think that at least the modern view in economics would be the creditor, that kind of artificial monopoly is probably not a common What is, however, very common, going back to our professional licensing, is state enforced monopoly of one sort or another. And that was the original meaning of the term, as you may know, things like salt monopoly, which is revenue sources. So, you know, the King of France or of England would say, how much will you offer me to be the only people allowed to sell salt? Great. I've got some money to, you know, hire troops or improve our palaces, buy jewelry or keep ones. And in the modern world, for example, it is illegal to compete with the post office delivering first class mail. We know that private firms that do very much what the post office does, because UPS and Federal Express do successfully compete with the post office and everything except delivering first class mail, which is one thing that I don't have to do. Until deregulation, airlines were not allowed to cut their prices without regulatory permission. And during that time, we had the interesting case of PSA, Pacific Southwest Airlines, flew between San Francisco and Los Angeles. The regulation only applied to interstate airlines, so they were not covered by the regulation. And their fare was about half the fare of similar length interstate. Probably
the two important sources of monopoly in the real world are either natural monopoly or government-enforced monopoly, and that while natural monopoly will sometimes occur on a large scale if there's some reason why a big firm has economies of scale, the place where I think it's really endemic is at the level of the single law firm in a small town, the single author with his fans who really like his books and don't like other books as much, and so forth. That's where it is. We'll get into more stuff later.